And we are back with episode 362 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, an internet. Leave Demon Lindehoff alone.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and what is it about Joss's hang-up on loading docks? I just can't figure it out to save my life.
And this is Bronstone from Australia, and say hello to my little friend, Science.
Yeah, and I kind of think that I want to go where Agent Coulson goes. Anywhere, really. Anytime he goes anywhere, it seems like he's had a lot of fun. Especially Tahiti. It's a magical place.
I've heard that.
All right, well, we are obviously going to be talking about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We're going to get into a bit of Person of Interest. And then we've got this the series finale out there that I don't think we've had a chance to talk about yet. Yeah, I think it's a show called Breaking Brad or something like that. But anyway, before we do that, Edmund, save me.
We will discuss absolutely everything about these shows, so you will all be horribly spoiled, you should have seen all of these anyway, so we certainly hope you have.
I know Lola does. Anyway, we are going to go ahead and start off right away with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and here's the promo.
We've been called in to investigate an 084. We all know what that means.
It means we don't know what that means.
This season, to investigate the strange and the unknown, five unlikely experts...
We just can't seem to understand each other.
...must become...
So work it out.
...the ultimate team.
Pretty kick-ass.
And trust us, you won't want to miss the very end of every episode. Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Watch it live all new next Tuesday.
All right, and let's see, that would be Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 1, Episode 2, getting ahead of myself there, 084, Coulson encounters Commandant Camila Reyes in Peru during a trip to investigate a mysterious object, and my reading skills are already starting to deteriorate. All right, let's go ahead and get this one started. Gary, why don't you start us off here, your highlight for this episode?
I had a few of them, honestly. Coulson, with this meeting of this Camilla or Camilla Reyes, we got a lot more background than I think people are actually realizing. Now, you know, it's been more than 3 years since he worked with her, so he's been around for that long. And they had seemed to have a sort of a working relationship that was really good. Particularly the shooting scene when the rebels first came out as they're back to back with each other, doing about 180 degree arc to clear the area around them. I thought that was very well choreographed, which I didn't think I'd get to use the word choreographed in this show, but that it almost felt like a dance, and I think that's the sort of the way it was shot. That was really good. I found it interesting, too, that 084s are sort of rare items, from what I'm told, you know, from what he sort of lets on. The last time was when he found Thor's hammer, which at this point has been, I think, probably a good year and a half or 2 years at this point.
Couple of years.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting that it's not a typical, you know, event or something that pops up that often. As far as the artifact itself, it seemed a little bit nebulous as to its construction. Peruvian scientists who were working with Hydra back in the 30s or early 40s were working on this, and it got lost and just happened to be embedded in a wall inside a temple from after falling out of an airplane or something. That was probably the weakest part for me. The funnest part is, just in general, and I've heard a lot of people comment on this, and I sort of felt it too. It felt very Firefly-ish, probably if for no other reason than we're working out of a flying machine with a big loading dock on the back of it. The visuals themselves certainly sort of lent itself to that. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I like that they switched up the dynamic a little bit from the first episode, which seemed extremely Coulson-centric. This one I felt was less so. We got some the character development that I was actually hoping for, that we didn't see in the pilot, is it was starting to come through. So overall, I think that this was a very good second episode, or I guess if you want to think of it, first regular episode. And finally, last but not least, before somebody else does it, as far as the cameo with Samuel L. Jackson, I was it was cute in some ways, but at the same time, it seemed awful gimmicky, and I can't imagine that we're going to be seeing him on a regular basis. Nor should we, honestly. I think it, I think it distracts from the sense of Coulson's importance when we sort of see him, yes, sir, you know, kowtowing as opposed to being the leader.
Yeah, I think that the thing with Fury would have worked a lot better if it hadn't been so advertised beforehand. I mean, if it had just been dropped in as a surprise, great, but knowing it was going to be there kind of took some of the shock value out of it.
Well, you can't expect people to wait till the end of the credits on a TV show, okay?
It says Marvel right at the start. People should know.
One does not simply leave before the end credits of a Marvel thing. And I'll have you know that as I'm saying this, I'm doing the hand gesture. Completely. Just on a total reflex.
That's right. It's necessary. All right. Bronze Thumb, since you obviously gave did the review for this one, why don't you go ahead and jump in with your comments or rebuttals or whatever else you want to call it.
I'm glad other people noticed all the Firefly things. I watched this episode with a bunch of my roommates who are all, you know, massive brown coats like me. So we're calling out all of the Firefly-esque things that happened. Of course, we start with the main character is in trouble on the vehicle that's like clearly broken, and then flashback to how we got here. Out of gas. We have all of these, like a lot of wonders and stuff like that, taking us through all the various, you know, aspects of the plane and getting a sense that there's a lot of big contiguous sets going on here. You get when they're escaping the temple. Ward totally has that thing that Simon had at the beginning of the movie, the bouncing Betty. They drive the cars right up, you know, straight up into the entry bay, which reminded me of the Barn Swallow. There were all kinds of little things, and I really dug that because it's not just recalling, you know, one of Joss Whedon's best things. It's taking that same approach to getting us into not just the greater universe, but this particular space. I really dug getting to know the bus a bit better, getting to kind of explore it a bit and have the characters explore it a bit, finding out, you know, figuring out where all the things are, because, you know, Firefly is still my favorite television show ever, and I love the fact that, you know, if by some crazy random happenstance I ever found myself on Serenity, I could totally get around. And after two episodes, I'm kind of getting that same feeling about the bus. I know where things are. And what's more, I'm getting a strong sense of the character's place within the, not just the physical, you know, realm of the show, but kind of the dramatic realm, how they're relating to each other bit by bit, where loyalties lie, the dynamics, the relationships and stuff like that. I like the fact that Sky is at once nerding out over all of the cool superhero stuff, and at the same time we find out she's kind of working for the bad guys. I like Coulson's casual indifference to almost everything. it's still awesome. You'd think this act is not getting old. Just that great attitude to everything. I like that Ward's kind of standoffish prickliness could have been really annoying and frustrating, but they mine a lot of humor out of that, as he just kind of is rubbish at relating to people. I liked that. I like this idea that finding out that May is just even more of a badass than any of us than we sort of previously suspected, to the point where the two science nerds are completely, you know, have fanboy fangirl moments at finding out who she actually is. I like the fact that that it's the two wacky scientists who are easily the most well-adjusted of the group and clearly have a very comfortable relationship with one another. And they're the ones just like, okay, we finished a mission, we brought the beer. That was a cool moment. So there's going through the episode, I was finding that was what I really dug about it. I liked getting to know the space of the show. And in all of its aspects, I think it was really, really successful. It was the more episodic elements of the episode that didn't do nearly as well. I felt like the twists, quote-unquote, were really obvious. Kind of as Gary said, the plot didn't entirely... like, it felt a bit cobbled together. It feels like they're still... like, last week we had, you know, Extremis and some other things, and this episode it's like, oh, it's Hydra, all that kind of thing. I want... This was where the show really should have, like, done something original. It should have forged a new mythology element, something that's either unique to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something that will that they introduce in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that may find its way into other Marvel things. But that's something that the show really has to start doing, because it can only mine the things we've seen in the movies for so long. And it felt disappointing that they weren't doing that. I thought, yeah, there was just a lot of obviousness and stuff like that. And while I did like a cool action sequence and stuff like that, in that sense, that the episode let me down. So I was really, really kind of at odds with myself over my opinion of the episode. It's at once things that I really, really loved, and at the same time, bits that very much left me cold.
Interesting. I mean, first of all, I'm now wondering whether or not this is just the stealthiest reboot of Firefly ever, because that would be hilarious if essentially he was using the success of the Avengers and his stuff to get Firefly back on TV by just calling it S.H.I.E.L.D.
John, be quiet.
I didn't say that. NSA, take care of
that
for
me. Amscray on the Firefly screen.
So far, we had Rod Glass show up. Castle is on ABC.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would be relatively easy to get Nathan Fillion in for an episode or two.
That's right.
Like, one by one. That's...
you know, he could steal some stuff from a S.H.I.E.L.D. base somewhere.
No, have a high body count. So, like, one by one.
That's right.
Of all regulars.
That would be hilarious, yeah. Actually. That would be the best thing ever. But anyhow, Edmund, your thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, I agree with much of what's already been said. Certainly, given my reservations about Sky being accepted so readily in the pilot, I liked seeing those immediately addressed and, becoming this pretty major plot point by the end. I liked that in no way were they being lazy about that. And I actually kind of liked the conceit of, one of the problems we were discussing coming out of the pilot of, it's all these disparate elements having to come together and then just, using that that need to bring them together as a team is kind of the conceit for the whole episode. You just can't say enough about Clark Gregg as this character. I mean, you can see why they said yes, we can hang a series on this guy, because him just sitting back saying, yeah, he should be figuring it out right about now, and may have been a little later than would have been ideal, but. Despite some of the sort of rote elements of the mission itself, it felt like a good next step to introducing us to the team and getting the team introduced to each other. And I can certainly see you know, this being a case where, you know, yes, right now, I mean, it is the more experienced members of the cast who are sort of, you know, coming off the best. I mean, you know, Clark Gregg and Ming-Na, you know, I mean, it's, you know, completely sells the idea of her being the cavalry. You know, and I can see with, you know, certainly given who's behind it, that, you know, that I can definitely see this being a case of, you know, it's sort of coming together in production as, you know, as the cast itself sort of starts bonding. It's the team is going to start getting better and better. So, you know, yeah, I'm, you know, I'm pleased so far. And, you know, yeah, look, you know, I completely agree with the idea of bringing in something of their own mythology into this, rather than just, you know, constantly referring to something we've already heard of before,
well,
which would be a great...
Well, yeah. I think they're doing that intentionally to sort of hook people, and I mean, S.H.I.E.L.D. by itself, before the Avengers, before movies, has a good 25, 30 years worth of history, so I mean, it's not that they don't have stuff they can't pull out of here, but at the same time, I think they're just trying to really sink their hooks into the audience, at least that's what I'm hoping they're doing.
Oh, absolutely! No! I understand it. You know, it being here in these early episodes, but yeah, coming up with something that is kind of unique to their universe, I think would be a good move. And certainly, if this is a Firefly reboot, I'm completely happy with that. Of course.
Now, on that note, I mean, yeah, I understand that there's this desire to have that take place where it kind of develops its own ongoing plot thread of its own villain, I guess you could say. Its own adversaries. At the same time, I kind of understand what it is that they're trying to do here. And I don't think they're trying to just crib off of the existing universe and kind of shoehorn their way into it. I think it's closer to the fact that there are implications that come out of those films of the larger context, and they're trying to show how that all weaves together, using this show as a bit of an avenue or a vehicle for that. But I fully expect them to come up with some kind of larger context to all of this. You know, it's Joss Whedon. This is his thing. He comes up in the first half of the season. Typically, there's what everyone thinks is the bad guy. In this case, Rising Tide, I would assume, would be that. And then there's always somebody else or something else bigger than that waiting in the wings, whether it's created by the original villain or it is, you know, the original villain, knowingly or not, is a front for the real adversary. And that's what I kind of see happening here, is that Rising Tide being, you know, they've already given some indications that they have legitimate ideas, legitimate complaints, legitimate approach to things, but their activities are questionable. At least some of them have questionable activities, specifically Sky actually does too. So is that just, are they just acting on their own, or is somebody using them? And I would suspect that somebody is using them. And it kind of reminds me of the stuff that's going on Continuum, for instance, where you have the proto-liberate movement and how they are going to eventually be used for other purposes. So, yeah, that I think it's going to happen, but I think also they do need to kind of show where they fit within the context of what has already been shown. And that's kind of the difficulty of being a spin-off of a movie universe. But that's just me. Bronstam, you gave this one a 7 out of 10.
I did give it a 7 out of 10. I went out with a very sort of average opinion of it because the really, really good things were outweighed by the things that really kind of left me cold. But before I go on, just one other thing. We all mentioned this sort of Firefly influence, but there was one other kind of big... I don't necessarily think it was an influence, but the more... Over the course of these two episodes, a similarity to another show is sort of really, really struck me, and I don't mind in the slightest. Is anyone else getting a really strong Crusade vibe off of this? Or is it just me?
There's a bit of it there. Just without the, you know, really bad soundtrack.
Gary, breathe.
I don't see where in God's name you pulled that from.
I feel like we've got like a really kind of breezy play, you know, sort of plays by his own rules, like, you know, team captain who pulls together this really, really eclectic team. They've got their own vehicle. They're going to travel around sort of dealing with, you know, particular problems that crop up. And when I start to think about where this show, what this show can do going forward, what I'm reminded of is all of the stuff we've heard about where Crusade was going to go going forward. Not necessarily the same thing, but the idea of, well, making these particular characters more distinct from the rest of the of the S.H.I.E.L.D. organization. I'm getting that vibe.
Well, that's a point that I actually have to call into question. My sense, while yes, I guess as far as we know, Coulson is this great troubleshooter, so they seem to send him, or at least I have a pet theory on that anyway, but I get the sense that no, this is what S.H.I.E.L.D. typically does. They have codes for these things. They have procedures for this stuff. This is, while they some of the events can be earth-shattering, per se, this is stuff they do every day. No, they are not one lone rogue team that is the only people capable of handling this particular issue. They have, you know, they just happen to be assigned to it. I get the sense that in some ways it is the everyman concept, albeit with, you know, a bigger, grander sort of arena to play in.
True. It's not the there is the whole universe thing of, like, you know, this stuff they've got code phrases and stuff for the things they investigate, and S.H.I.E.L.D. does this kind of thing or whatever. But we do have, I mean, part of the idea is that this is, you know, Coulson is sort of one of the best S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. agents there is, and he's put together his own crack team, and they're the ones getting sent to investigate the 084 and things like that. The team in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they're kind of the response team. They're what the Avengers were originally supposed to be. They're the frontline thing. It's like, well, this is weird. Let's send these particular guys out to have a look. Like, they're okay. And yet another comparison jumps to mind. They're SG-1. They're not the only team, but they're kind of the best team.
Okay, I'll give you that conceit, yes, but as I said, but I still get the sense that they're not wholly unique, I guess might be what.
No, they're not wholly unique, and I'm looking forward to when the show will inevitably introduce, like, another S.H.I.E.L.D. team, and I really hope it's kind of like every other, like it's one of those things where they've just, like, it's Coulson's sitcom arch nemesis, the leader of this other team. They kind of grumble at each other, and they were arch rivals at the S.H.I.E.L.D. training academy and things like that. But Coulson's crew is supposed to be kind of weird. Like, he picked up, you know, one of the best stealth infiltratory kind of people there is. He picked up the cavalry. He picked up two of these, you know, crack sciencey people, and then he grabbed a you know, high tech cyber hacker just along the way.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it the conceit supposed to be that no one else knows Coulson is there? That this is a secret team to some extent?
I don't think so.
Enough people seem to say, oh, hell, hi, you know, Coulson this, Coulson that. A fair number of people know that he's breathing and existing, so
It's level 7. Like, the Avengers don't know.
Yeah. But here's the thing, right?
No,
to your point, Bronstum, the vibe that I get from this is that there are certain people within the organization that know what's going on here and know that what Coulson's real objective is. And that Coulson eventually is going to find out the truth about what it is that why he's there and why he was given this opportunity to do this team and everything else. And I could see that going into some surprisingly dark territory where we question, what is S.H.I.E.L.D. really doing?
I think he knows all along, is my opinion. I think he already knows.
But to me, wasn't there in the pilot, there was that one moment where, okay, they did talk about the fact that, you know, Coulson doesn't know the truth about his quote-unquote vacation.
Oh, you mean when Book was talking?
Okay, but wasn't there another character? I think it was Ward, in fact, that when he mentioned, oh, I was in Tahiti, and he says, oh, you know, that's such a magical place or something like that. There was some kind of indication that one of the other characters, at least I picked up this, and maybe I was just misinterpreting it, that there was another character that had also, quote-unquote, been there. And that there's... It just... There feel like there's an undercurrent to all this that has...
As they mentioned it was a magical place every time they say it.
That's what picked it up. He mentioned it to Ward, and I remember not getting a lot out of Ward's reaction other than, like... he used that same phrase, and then he used it again in this episode with Sky, and just the fact that it's this kind of, like it's a whole Manchurian candidate. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, Tahiti is the kindest, mm-hmm. bravest, gentlest, sexiest place I've ever been.
Yeah, and it's just, to me, it feels like it's rife for there to be something bigger behind his purpose, and the purpose of his team. Why are these people allowed to be on his team? Are they considered expendable? What's the real reason for all of this? Because clearly it can't just be what's on Book. No, pun intended. So, I think there's a lot more going on here, but it's only two episodes in, so it's kind of hard to pigeonhole it at this point. Just to wrap this one up, Gary, what would you give this one?
I'm gonna give it an 8. I really I enjoyed it. It was fun, quick paced. As I said, we got more character development, so I'll go with the 8.
Okay, Edmund.
I'm between a 7 and an 8, but I think I will go with a 7, if only because I don't think a life raft does what they think a life raft does.
Oh poo! I gave it an 8. Anyway. It still comes out a little bit lower than the premiere, but not dramatically so. All right, so we're going to go ahead and move on to Person of Interest, and here's the promo.
CBS Next Tuesday. They know all about you.
It's learning everything about a person.
He's a data broker.
But they aren't the only ones watching.
I've got nothing to hide.
Things are getting interesting.
Mr. Kruger, you've got a great many people.
A new Person of Interest. CBS Next Tuesday.
All right, and that one is Person of Interest, Season 3, Episode 2, Nothing to Hide. A number comes up for an online entrepreneur who routinely invades other people's privacy, but then finds his own being attacked. Meanwhile, Carter is paired with a new rookie partner. Oh boy, here we go with the almost all-too-obvious exploration of secrets and online privacy and everything else. The machine just laughs. And wherever it happens to be hiding. Edmund, you are our usual guru for a Person of Interest. Your highlights and/or lowlights, quickly, succinctly.
Certainly, obviously, with this number, I mean the sort of critique of how much people reveal online has kind of been implicit in the show. Them pointing out like how much they can learn off someone's online profile, and then those people who have no online presence and they have a harder time with. And this was the episode that was sort of bringing it all to the fore with rather obviously named Life Trace as the company, and there is kind of this conceit going on where, I mean, yes, you know, they always say the number could be a victim or a perpetrator, although for some reason they seem to wind up being victims more often than not. And there's a little bit of misdirection with this since the Kruger, the head of this company, is not too sympathetic. He that stunt he pulls with the baby rattle at the client presentation, you know, really is kind of creepy since, there are reasons why people don't always reveal that they're pregnant. And the sexist remarks about his assistant. And, so they seem to be setting it up to where, you know, okay, maybe this is a bad guy. And then, of course, it turns out he's under attack from all sorts of different avenues. And, the intriguing part of the episode is it's this these attacks that are using kind of all of these things that the machine usually is what usually gives our team access to, whether it's hacking his birthday, his anniversary video, and finding they're bugging him when they get, you know, they record the sexist comment and getting into his bank accounts. And certainly the conceit of having this all coming from different plaintiffs in this class action suit, who it turns out are not coordinating themselves, but there's someone behind it who's feeding all this information to them. So it's sort of piecemeal taking him down was the intriguing part of the episode. And I guess I'll jump because that kind of leads into the one thing that really got to me in this episode was this whole plot point of them bringing him to the library. And they have made such a point about, sort of keeping this place anonymous, and, nobody can find out about it. And then, they not only bring him there, but then he attacks Finch, Bear is there, and Bear just, rips his trouser leg. And it's like, this is a special forces trained attack dog who just had his master attacked. And it just particularly annoyed me because, it's been well established that, Finch had kind of, has these apartments that he pulls out of the hat, at a moment's notice, throughout the series. So, why they had to sort of, have all that happen in the inner sanctum really annoyed me. I mean, it was one of those, yelling at the TV moments, but,
That was your sticking point, I think, to say the least. Don't mean to interrupt you, but let's go ahead and get Bronstam. I think you watched this as well. What was your thought on that?
I don't know. It's the whole episode was a little too. The whole episode was kind of a little too shortcutty. Person of Interest has usually been really good about, having a really solid way of getting from point A to point B, but by the end of the episode, I felt like the writers had cut a lot of corners in order to get to the particular point of establishing villains, and therefore, it kind of undercut everything effective that was going on in the episode.
Yeah, I mean, that to me was probably more the issue. I mean, yes, that was a shortcut. But, I mean, I think we've alluded to it here. The first half of this episode felt like it was going nowhere. It introduced a couple things, but it just felt slow, plodding, very small in scale. It was just, it felt like it was conventional in all the wrong ways. And it wasn't until the second half that some of the layers and implications started to finally come into play. But there were so many other places they could have taken this, and they didn't go there. And that, I think, was the part that I found a little bit disappointing, especially this being the second episode of the season. I would think that they'd kind of got past the shaking things down in the premiere, where they had to reintroduce some of the dynamics. But here it felt like they just were cutting corners.
Yeah, I mean, very much like a conventional episode, and not even a conventional episode of Person of Interest necessarily. I mean, yes, the elements were there, and even with the other major thread of Carter, and continuing her story, the visit to the grave, to Cal's grave, where, you know, Quinn happens to be there, we just get it, completely, just sort of laid out that, she's still on HR's radar, and then this rookie partner shows up who, such the complete rookie stereotype, up to and including the puking the first time he sees a body. And it just seems obvious to me that, that yes, he's an HR plant, or at the very least, he's going to get, used by HR at some point. But it seems to me that most likely he's HR from the beginning. It was all leading up to this twist at the end where, we kind of finally get to the point of, the person who's been manipulating all this is not the person they were pointing at, but this other shadowy group. So apparently this is going to be our new nemesis for this season, who's, not the government. It's not the NSA protecting their property, but this other group that seems to be doing things similar to what the machine does, but with far, far fewer scruples. Having the number get shot, they have lost numbers before, but not in quite so dramatic a fashion. It is setting up, I hope, some interesting stuff, but at the same time, the manner in which they got there was just feeling a little too rote.
Now, you gave this one, Edmund, a 7 out of 10.
Yep.
Okay, Bronstone, what do you think? Agree, disagree?
I think I don't disagree. I think a 7 is a good number. It it had cool moments. I'm interested in where this new villain goes, because I think they did a decent job of making them appear, this group, this organization, and the face of it that we see feel impressive, and like they'll be an interesting nemesis, although not necessarily a good big bad. But they did take a lot of shortcuts to get there, and that are really noticeable the way that the whole episode is constructed. Plus, is there anyone who doesn't think Carter's new partner is going to be HR? I mean, really? Really?
What makes you say that? Anyway.
I don't know.
Indeed. I am going to give this one a 7 as well. I think that I was in between a 7 and an 8, and I think that this just kind of made it all gel in my head as to why I felt that it was a little bit lower than the premiere. But a rocky start for the third season of Person of Interest, unfortunately. I'm hoping that they can turn things around. I'm sure they can. I mean, we've seen them do far better than this, and this is just an uncharacteristic start to a season. All right, well, what some people may consider the main event for this particular show, here we are with the series finale, excuse me, of Breaking Bad. Yeah. Here's the promo.
Chemistry is the study of transformation.
What would you do if it all came back to you? What would you say if you had to leave today?
What the hell is wrong with you? We're a family!
If you leave this place, you will get caught.
Why are you still alive?
Go ahead! Do it!
Please don't hurt my baby.
It's over. I've still got things left to do.
Breaking Bad, the series finale, next Sunday night at 9, only on AMC.
All right, and this is the most spoiler-filled description ever. Breaking Bad, Season 5, Episode 16, Felina, I believe it is. And here's the recap. The acclaimed crime drama comes to a close in the series finale. What kind of detail did they think they could...
Just give the ending away.
I know. But anyhow, here we go. Breaking Bad, series finale. Guys, take it away.
Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it didn't end like Dexter.
Yeah.
Yes,
if he pulled on a plaid shirt and headed north, I think we all would have destroyed our television. So.
No lumberjacks in sight.
No.
I can't think of a single thing. Okay, literally the only thing about this episode that I will have any complaint about is the lack of Saul. I thought there'd be Saul.
Yeah.
There was no Saul. I wish there was Saul. But...
They're saving him for the spin-off.
Yeah, just beat for beat, this whole episode was just fantastic. It wasn't as... it wasn't as necessarily as crazy or as gut-wrenchingly emotional like in its immediacy as something like Ozymandias. But it felt like... It felt like there were maybe about 12 big long beats in this episode, moments of Walter White just going from one character or group of characters to another and just resolving things. Like that was mm-hmm. the mission. That was what we saw the flash forwards over the course of a couple of them and wondering, okay, what's his mission? What's he back for? And what he's back for is to basically seek the resolution that everyone watching the show wants. and some of them were really effectively emotional. His scene with Skylar, I absolutely loved, even though we got to the end and I was still expecting there to be something like she had developed lung cancer, because that would have been cruelly ironic. But no, they didn't do that. But just the moment of him being truthful for once,
yes.
and really kind of saying the thing that we had all come to realize over the course of the show, that, you know what, this was, as much as he might have said it was for his family, as much as he might have believed it at various points, the real reason that Heisenberg came into being was because it was...
like, make those connections for him, but maybe he was able to, and then that brilliant reveal of, you know, yes, Sneaky Pete and Badger are still part of, you know, are going to be part of the finale because they just helped ensure that Walt Jr. is going to get his money.
I was not expecting those two to show up. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. Because we had that really funny moment with them earlier in this half season, and it was commented, more than a few commenters took that scene, and I, you know, agree with them. Kind of took that scene as, well, this is kind of their swan song. There's really not a lot for Badger and Skinny Pete to do for the rest of the season, so we're just going to kind of let them...
This is Walt, you know, still coming up with, you know, with a brilliant, cunning plan, you know, using the elements he actually has. And, I actually liked that part of it, because they made clear from the beginning. I mean, also, I mean, this is about a guy who's dying. It's like, you know, no, this is the story that comes to an end. It comes to a conclusion, and they were determined to drive it there. And, you know, and I thought they just did it really, really well, in keeping with the characters, and also in keeping with, having this wonderful cast and, giving them all, as many of them as possible. I certainly agree. Having Saul somewhere, would have been nice, one last chance to shine. And, certainly, that final Walt and Skyler scene, I consider really the core of the episode. And also I thought it was just beautifully shot by Vince Gilligan. He wrote and directed this one. But just that whole thing of, having it lined up so that, Walt's behind the pillar, and then after he gets off the phone, just doing that little pan over so that you see that he's been there the whole time. And even there, it was, even though the Schwartzes, I was kind of thinking that was where it was going to go, really not being sure which way that was going to turn. And that whole sequence of, you know, him going into I did it all for, and her breaking in and saying, you know, don't you dare tell me for the, you know, for the family, and then him, you know, as you said, finally coming clean and being honest about it. You know, I just really feel was sort of, you know, that was the whole heart of the finale right there, was Walt finally saying out loud what it had really been all about for him. And yeah, go ahead.
I feel like there's been obviously debate and chatter and stuff like that about the state of Walt in this episode and stuff like that. And what I felt like more and more as the episode went on is that what we finally see in the in this last episode is a Heisenberg that's done, like that's finished cooking. Mm-hmm. And as I said that, I realized it could be taken the wrong way. but like it's the whole show has been the transformation of Walter White, mild-mannered chemistry teacher with serious ego problems, into Heisenberg. And what we finally got to in this episode was he has finally finished becoming. Because always core, you know, this key struggle of the character is that even though I you know, he's absolutely right when he says in this episode, I did it for me. He's always done it for himself. But that's not to say there wasn't a part of him that genuinely thought or at least made the excuse that, no, I'm doing this for my family.
Yeah.
And that's this kind of core thing, was like he kind of wants to be the family man. He wants to be successful. He wants his Walter White life to be successful, but at the same time, he wants to be Heisenberg. He wants to be this, he wants to be feared. He wants people to have that awed reaction. He wants to be powerful. And those two objectives have conflicted with one another. And what we got here was that finally he's in sync. Is that he doesn't have that necessarily that internal conflict anymore. He's reached his final form as someone who he is Walter White, you know, and he is Heisenberg at the same time. He wants to do the right thing by his family, and he does it to the best of his abilities. When he comes by and sees Skylar, he says, like, this is where you'll find Hank and Gomi. Make the deal with the DEA, mm-hmm. Get out from under this.
Yep.
He does he's looking out for his family, but he's very callous and cold and scheming in the way he does it. It's just everything is in sync, and that continues over the whole episode, and it's fascinating. And what's more amazing is that you wind up having sympathy for him again. Well, maybe not sympathy. Maybe sympathy is not the right word, but for the first time in a long time, we find ourselves kind of rooting for Walt because he seek that resolution to do the right thing by his family, to use that cunning and that scheming and all those aspects of Walter White and Heisenberg to try and do the right thing by the people he's wronged. Even though he does it in an incredibly rubbish way, like, I mean, what he says to the Schwartzes is like, now we're finally even, as though there was a legitimate score to settle, and using at the same time using those properties to kind of take revenge on the people he thinks that are genuinely justified in it, in seeking revenge against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say it's more that, I mean, he kind of earns our respect in the end. That you know, yeah. Taking the Heisenberg persona and, you know, and as you say, you know, deploying it to, you know, to still take, you know, take care of as best he can. I mean, who knows how it will actually work out, but, you know, at least do his level best to provide for his son, to get his, you know, keep his wife out of jail and, you know, and, you know, and take care of, you know, the people who've been, you know, at this point set up, you know, as the real bad guys, or the current bad guys, however you want to look at it. You know, yeah, and there was sort of, you know, so, you know, there was definitely sort of that sense of a checklist to it. But at the same time, I mean, it was all, you know, it wasn't like it just felt, you know, yeah, I mean, it didn't feel rote in any way. I mean, it was still, you know, Walter White, you know, figuring out these, you know, kind of unique ways of doing things, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's the laser pointers or, making sure there's, and I'm blanking on the name of that sweetener that she loves, but, you know, there's only the one packet there to make sure that, that she gets the rice in. And, you know, and if anything, the, you know, the only sort of minor criticism I had was, you know, I kind of wish they hadn't telegraphed the garage opener as much as they did.
That was great. Like you see him set it up, you see him rig it, you see him drive up, and by the time he pulls up and he gets in the room, you realize what his plan is. The tension is not what's he going to do. The tension is the involvement of Jesse. Because, this is another thing that's been debated about, and it really, really surprised me, because he absolutely went there, like, he went there to kill Uncle Jack and all the Nazis, but, this show is kind of awesome that I could legitimately say that Bryan Cranston went to kill all the Nazis. Go back in time 10 years and tell people that's an awesome series finale for a show. but... absolutely top on the list was killing Jesse.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I don't think, after the Schwartz, and it wasn't the top of the list until after he went to the Schwartz's and after he talked to Badger and Skinny Pete, and they said that, and he sort of realized that Jesse must be involved in the continued production of Blue Meth. that was first and foremost on the hit list. He thought that Jesse had betrayed him once. Jesse had worked with the DEA and ratted him out. Naturally, he was continuing to betray him. He was working with the people who stole all his money. He was using his formula. He was just in Walt's mind, Jesse had become his arch nemesis. It was first thing on the list, and that's where, for me at least, the tension in that scene was how is that going to resolve? Will he really, you know, will he figure it out? I mean, we kind of skipped a little bit over that that one Jesse scene that we had earlier in the episode, where I don't think he says a word, but we had the juxtaposition of his dreamlike flashback of making that box that he talked about earlier in the show with continuing to make blue meth, and to me at least sort of suggesting that that's the kind of thing he's going to go and do with his life.
So now, what bronze thumb would you give this episode?
I don't know. I'm wondering whether or not it's to sort of maybe knock it down a point or something for the fact there's no Saul or that we didn't get a lot of Walt Jr. or anything, but I got to give it a 10. It wrapped everything up, and there were just so many great emotional beats with the other characters, and there were so many moments of that's awesome, whether it was in this kind of like grim sort of like begrudging respect stance, like the ploy he pulled with the Schwartzes with the laser pointers and all that. It was just like, that's cold, but at the same time, that was kind of awesome. Right down to, you know, say hello to my little friend, where, yeah, science teacher mows down like a dozen neo-Nazis with a machine gun rigged in the boot of his car that's triggered by the beeper. There's just that moment was as awesome as they set it up to be from minute one, and what made it all the better was the fact that just it was the fact that it was in the midst of that thing of just like him having that realization about Jesse and having really that last big, you know, grasp at doing the right thing by saving Jesse and in the process basically signing his own death warrant.
Right.
It was
Yeah.
It was just this perfect way for the character to go out, for the series to go out. And yeah, it was just brilliant start to finish.
And you, Edmund?
Yeah, I've got to admit, I was thinking of a 9, but now that we've talked about it, Bronze Thumbs convinced me it was a 10 as well. I realize some of my reservations that I don't necessarily need to be reserved about. So yeah, and also, I mean, that element of, you know, because yes, I agree, Jesse was supposed to be one of the ones taken out, and basically that whole element of Walt basically protecting Jesse at, you know, as it winds up, the expense of his own life, combined with then, I mean, the part that I actually didn't even realize sort of at the time, it sunk in later with, you know, of Walt dying in the meth lab. So naturally everybody thinks he was the one who was doing the cooking and Jesse is really home free.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, I've absolutely 10 out of 10.
With the added thing of, as Vince Gilligan so aptly put it in many of the interviews afterwards, was that Walt died with his precious, his meth lab.
Yes.
Well, I can say this, all right, to perhaps wrap this up, because the question is going to be out there. We seem to hit a new bar last season with the first season of Hannibal. And there's been this ongoing question, have we hit the new bar with the final season of Breaking Bad? I actually had to go down to the hundredths of a point here in order to decide it. But when you do that, Hannibal came out at 8.87. Breaking Bad comes out at 8.91. So, Breaking Bad is the new standard bearer for the best season since we started this whole thing. So there we are. There's the new bar.
So get on that, Brian Fuller.
That's right. We now have a competition.
Yes.
Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...